Let's take our Bibles. We're going to go to Genesis chapter 32 this morning. Genesis chapter 32. We're kind of changing chapters when it comes to the story of Jacob. He's on his way home. He's just said goodbye to Laban. In fact, let's pick up the story in verse 55 of the previous chapter. We're going to read down through 21 of chapter 32. We'll begin in 31, verse 55. Early in the morning, Laban arose and kissed his grandchildren and his daughters and blessed them. Then Laban departed, and he went home. The word is to his place. Jacob went on his way, and the angels of God met him, and when Jacob saw them, he said, "This is God's camp." So he called the name of that place Mahanaim. And Jacob sent messengers before him to Esau, his brother, in the land of Seir, the country of Edom, instructing them, "Thus shall you say to my lord Esau, thus says your servant Jacob, I have sojourned with Laban and stayed until now. I have oxen, donkeys, flocks, male servants, female servants. I have sent to tell my lord in order that I may find favor in your sight." The messengers returned to Jacob saying, "We came to your brother Esau, and he's coming to meet you, and there are 400 men with him." Then Jacob was greatly afraid and distressed. He divided the people who were with him and the flocks and herds and camels into two camps, thinking, "If Esau comes to the one camp and attacks it, then the camp that is left will escape." Jacob said, "O God of my father Abraham and God of my father Isaac, O Lord, who said to me, 'Return to your country and to your kindred, that I may do you good,' I am not worthy of the least of all the deeds of steadfast love and of all the faithfulness that you have shown to your servant. For with only my staff I have crossed this Jordan, and now I have become two camps. Please deliver me from the hand of my brother, from the hand of Esau, for I fear him. He may come and attack me, the mothers with the children. But you said, 'I will surely do you good, and make your offspring as the sand of the sea, which cannot be numbered for multitude.'" So he stayed there that night, and from what he had with him, he took a present for his brother Esau: 200 female goats, 20 male goats, 200 ewes and 20 rams, 30 milking camels and their calves, 40 cows, 10 bulls, 20 female donkeys, 10 male donkeys. These he handed over to his servants, every drove by itself, and said to his servants, "Pass on ahead of me and put a space between drove and drove." He instructed the first, "When Esau, my brother, meets you and asks you, 'To whom do you belong? Where are you going? And whose are these ahead of you?' Then you shall say, 'They belong to your servant Jacob. They are a present sent to my lord Esau. And moreover, he is behind us.'" He likewise instructed the second and the third and all who followed the droves, "You shall say the same thing to Esau when you find him, and you shall say, 'Moreover, your servant Jacob is behind us.' For he thought, 'I may appease him with the present that goes ahead of me. Afterward, I shall see his face. Perhaps he will accept me.' So the present passed on ahead of him, and he himself stayed that night in the camp." On September 23rd, in 1999, just 15 years ago this season, NASA lost a $125 million Mars orbiter. I just heard about this recently. I probably heard it at the time. It just didn't register for me. But my kids are studying science, and their science lesson that brought up this story of this Mars orbiter that NASA lost. NASA lost it because of one simple mistake. The guys who were designing the program for the orbiter and the guys who were working on the overall program for the orbiter, they were working together, and as they were talking about the same things, they were actually using different dimensions in the way that they were programming and preparing for this orbiter to work. You see, the one guys over in Dallas were using the metric system. The one over here were using the English units of inches and so on. And so as this $125 million piece of machinery was entering close to Mars, it had to fire off its rockets, and it did it just a little too hard. And so it started to go into the atmosphere where it burned up the controls and plowed through the atmosphere. And for all we know today, this piece of machinery is just orbiting the sun. A simple mistake. And they learned a lot from it. $125 million mistake. One person using inches, another person using centimeters. You say, man, that's so simple. I mean, they should have talked about that a long time ago. You're right, they should have. But you ever make those simple mistakes? You look back and you say, man, it's so obvious. How can something so simple cost so much? And yet it does. But NASA's not the only one that makes mistakes based on simple miscalculations. I'm thankful that even though that whole mission was scrubbed because of that miscalculation, God doesn't do that with us. We make mistakes, we miscalculate, but God is able to compensate for when we fail. The things that we don't do right, He's able to keep us on course, on mission, on target. But for our text this morning, it demonstrates that we too are capable of making mission-threatening miscalculations. And I think none of these calculations can be miscalculated so greatly as Jacob's. When we come to Jacob's story, he's entering back into the land. God has promised to bless him. God has told him to take this venture of obedience. And as he just gets done with one threat, Laban chases him down and finds nothing in his camp, even though there were false gods present. Jacob swears by the name of his father's God, the fear of Isaac. And he says, this God who is real is the one who is going to keep me, preserve me, and bless me as I go off into this venture of obedience that I'm called to by God. And so we see one threat is down. And as soon as he steps foot in the land, all of a sudden, on the radar enters Esau. And 20 years ago, we know why he had to leave Canaan. It was because of Esau. Esau who wanted to kill him. And so for 20 years, he spends time in Paddan Aram with Laban. He gains two wives, Laban's daughters. He gains 11 sons and one daughter, 12 children in the 20 years that have intervened. And as Laban changed his wages 10 times and tricks him other times than that, all of a sudden he's coming back and he gets rid of that headache and he enters the land and here's a brand new headache. And at the very beginning of this entering into the land, we see that God gives Jacob a defining vision. A vision that we read about in only two verses. In fact, it's comprised of only four words in the Hebrew language. Verses 1 and 2. Jacob went on his way. The angels of God met him. What does that tell us? Well, it tells us that the angels of God met him. That's all we have. Don't you wish you knew what that looked like? I mean, like, were they bright? Were they big? Were they smiling? That word met can mean they met him with swords, or they met him with muscles, they met him with a smile, met him with a hand. What does it mean? These angels met? Were there a lot of them? Was there two? There's angels. What does this look like? All we know is that the angels of God met him. And when Jacob saw them, he said, this is God's camp. So he called the name of that place Mahanaim. That's what sets up this story of Jacob's return to the promised land. It's kind of a punctuation mark. It's an exclamation point, if you will. He's beginning this venture of obedience. He's just given him victory. God's given Jacob victory over Laban. Laban says, you know, it's in my power. It's in the strength of my hand to crush you. But your God came to me last night and said, I can't do that. But I want to. Don't think it's for lack of desire. God gives him victory over Laban. Now he steps into this promised land, right on the border. He turns around, and as soon as he does, that's how the narrative presents it. As soon as he just turns around, all of a sudden, boom, here's the angels of God that meet him. Jacob sizes things up. He says, you know what? I've seen something like this before. When I left this place, God's angels showed up to me then. on a staircase leading all the way up to heaven. We called that the house of God, Beth El. This is the camp of God. And he says, this is none other than Mahanaim. The word means two camps. We've got to look at this just a little bit to understand how this story is set up. This vision that God gives to Jacob comes on the pathway of obedience. God had told him back in chapter 31, we're told that he had been given a vision. He's supposed to go to the land that God had promised him, back to the land of his fathers, the land of his kindred. And as he's going back to the land, all of a sudden, God decides to give him a vision of the place where heaven and earth have intersected. That place where the mundane and the divine come head to head. You know what? It's an important thing for us to keep in mind, that whenever we are on the pathway of obedience, it's never just the mundane that we're accomplishing. If it's something that God has told us to do, if it's something that God has commissioned us to do, if it's some place that God has commissioned us to go, that moment, as I am entering into that pathway of obedience, it becomes the intersection of heaven and earth, because God himself has given me a directive. You need to share the gospel with that person. And all of a sudden, in time and space and history, God is working from heaven on planet earth in the location and the place where he's asked you to be obedient. That's an amazing thing. This vision, if you will, comes on the pathway of obedience, and it's underscored by the fact it says it's the angels of God. This is the second place in all of the Old Testament where this phrase is used. Two times. The angels of God, the messengers of God, the ones sent from God's presence. The only other place that it's used is back at the Bethel vision, back in chapter 28. This is an amazing thing. They met him. It doesn't say anything about the nature of this confrontation. Are they for him? Are they against him? It doesn't say anything that was communicated. Did they talk? Did they do sign language? How? Me from God, you go promised land. What was the nature of that? We're not told. Just four little words were given. But we are told that this was initiated by God. As he's on this pathway to obedience, God says, Jacob, I want you to understand what's at stake as you come back into this promised land. See here, I have a host of angels. And as you come back on this pathway of obedience, I want you to understand what it is that you're getting yourself into. You're obeying me. I've called you to this point. Now look it. Here's what you're entering into. It's kind of like what Ephesians chapter 6 says. We wrestle not with flesh and blood, but against the principalities, against the powers, against the rulers of the darkness of this world. And God, for just a moment, pulls back the curtain of the invisible and says, Jacob, as you come back into the promised land, I want you to have a vision of what's at stake. This is my army. This is my host. This is my camp. And they're right here with you. And God had promised back in chapter 31, when you go back into the promised land, I will be with you. And so it's probably best to see this, to perceive this as something that's positive. They're not coming to oppose Jacob. They're coming to strengthen Jacob. They're coming to assist Jacob. But can you imagine the terror of that moment? It would be like when Joshua enters into the promised land and he lifts up his eyes and he sees the captain of the Lord of hosts. He goes over to him, and he says, listen, you for us or against us? And the guy says, no. No to which part? Shut up and take your shoes off. Okay. Wow. Man, this is like a commanding presence. And God pulls back the scene of history for just a moment, pulls back that veil of the invisible and says, Jacob, when you're obeying me, this is what's at stake. I've given an order, and it's not just you who are being obedient, but I've commissioned all of my host to be involved in your mission of obedience. I don't know about you, but I don't think of myself as anybody very significant in the program of God. Okay? Nobody in my family has ever done anything tremendous and great as far as spiritual accomplishments. Nobody's ever called down fire from heaven in my family that I know. I don't think any leprosy plagues have been stopped by a great prayer of one of my relatives. I don't think of myself as anybody great in God's program. And the truth is, in God's program, Jacob wasn't either. But God says, it's not about you, Jacob, and your greatness. Your obedience is all about me and my greatness. And so sometimes we don't think, you know, God's given me what? This role to play off in this corner of the world. How significant is that? God says, just a minute. Let me show you how significant this is. You know who all's with you in this venture? Okay, did you see that? Whoa. Okay, guess I better play my part. And so as he moves forward, this vision comes on the path of obedience and it defines his relationship while it's on the move. When he gets the first vision, he says, there's a stairway between heaven and earth. Okay, it touches heaven and it touches the ground. This is what Babel was supposed to be about, building a staircase to heaven, a highway to heaven, if you will, if we're in Michael Landon's terms. This is the place, this is the gateway of not the gods, of the one God that there is. This is his residence. This is the place, the permanent. Wow. As he looks at this vision now, he says, you know what? This is different from that place, that settled, developed, stable place where God's presence is entered into. This is a camp. This is something that's on the move. There's a host. I don't know if angels have tents. I don't know how he knew this was a camp. Okay, but he recognizes it as different. Several of the commentators comment that probably what's being communicated to Jacob at this point is, Jacob, you remember all these angels? You've seen them before. You probably recognize Gabriel. Maybe Michael was in. I don't know. Do you recognize them? But he says, you know who they are. When you left this place, you met them. As you come back to this place, I'm introducing you to them again. But here's the point, Jacob. They're here because I promised to be with you. In fact, when you left, I promised to be with you. You know who was with you the whole time when you were in Paddan Aram? Oh, you know it. You told it. You told your wives that back in chapter 31, verse 3, verse 10. God is with you, okay? These angels, they've moved wherever you've moved. My presence gone with you wherever you've gone. Do you think about God being with you? I don't think about that very often. But Hebrews chapter 13, verse 5 says, now listen, those of you who are tempted to complain about what you don't have, those who are discontent with what you do have, be content with such things as you have, for he hath said, I will never, in other words, I will always be with you wherever you go. On my pathway of obedience. Sometimes I go places where there's lots of people and I like being there. And it feels like we've got momentum and we're going the same direction. Sometimes obedience looks like I'm going in a place where I feel all by myself and I'm walking one way and everybody else is walking against me and I'm working against the crowd. It doesn't matter whether I feel like many are with me or many are against me. God says, you know who's with you? I am. I am. Wherever I've called you to go, I'll go with you. Sometimes you feel like you're in a valley. You're all by yourself. Sometimes that valley, like Jacob, is a valley of your own making. You've entered it through the doorway called sin, and you're wandering around in the wilderness of sin. And you're wondering as God's sheep, oh, where did God go? You're looking over your shoulder. When you cry out to God, all you get is this echo in this canyon. Where's God in the middle of your sin, your failure, your wandering? Same place he's always been. I will never leave you nor forsake you. That's an amazing thing, isn't it? that I can't find anywhere that I can escape the presence of my God. That's a comfort. Because we're like sheep wandering away, all going astray, the book of Isaiah says. But God, in his love, reaches down and grabs us and says, wherever you go, I promise to go with you. This is a camp. It's on the move. And it's moving with Jacob. In fact, the angels of God meet him as he leaves Canaan and returns, probably indicates their presence with him during the intervening time as well. Probably he takes it as a promise that not only were they with him then, but they'll be with me in the rest of my journeys. What I'm entering into is none other than the presence of God in my adventure of obedience. Well, doesn't that make you want to obey God? Doesn't that make you want to roll up your sleeves and dig into the work? Man, this isn't dependent on me and my weak little muscles. You look like Popeye and your bicep goes in the wrong direction. Okay. My obedience and the accomplishment of God's program isn't dependent on me. It's dependent on God, who commands a host to accomplish his purpose. And I just get to be a part of it. It comes on the border of blessing. This blessing, as Jacob is leaving the promised land, is promised to him. And back in chapter 28, Jacob, I'll do this for you, I'll do that for you, I'll give you this land, I'm going to give you many kids. In fact, through you, all the world will be blessed. And I won't leave you until I do everything that I've told you that I will do for you. I promise. That's a wonderful promise. Doesn't look like it's happening too quickly for 14 years. Finally, during the last 6 years, he starts to get a little bit of wealth, children, things are starting to come together for him. But then he comes back into the promised land, and at the end of this chapter, we're going to see that this promise becomes a reality. As he's going to wrestle with the angel of God, he's going to say, I'm not going to let you go until you bless me. And that passage at the end of this chapter is going to say, and so God blesses Jacob there, in this place. And it's going to be an intense wrestling match at the end of this chapter. We're not going to get there today, but we're looking forward to that. This is where this is going. He's taking that blessing that has been promised in the past, and he's returning to the land of blessing, and he's going to enter not just into the presence of God and his angels, but he's going to enter very really into the blessing of God. And it's going to be tangible. He's going to get his fingers into it as he progresses down this path of obedience. So it says there in verse 2, he calls the name of this place Mahanaim. The idea is there, it's two camps. The I am at the end means two. Camp of two. There's two camps here. Well, that's great. What are the two camps? There's God's camp and there's... maybe. The other camp, it might be Laban's camp, who's just walking off into the sunset. Maybe it's Esau's camp, just coming around the corner. Maybe it's Jacob's camp. So many people have written on this, and nobody agrees. Okay, what are the two camps? We don't know. Well, we know one of them is God's, and one of them, the implication is, one of them is God's camp, and one of them is not God's. That's the implication, right? Okay. One of the camp is God's camps. One of the camp is not God's camp. That's where Jacob makes his mistake. Because as God shows up on the scene, he says, Jacob, I am with you. Jacob says, this is an amazing thing. God's just pulled back the veil of the invisible, and he's let me see into his camp. Now I come to this realization. There's two camps. There's God's camp, and there's the camp that's not God's. You ever feel like that? There's God's camp, and then there's my camp. I wish my camp was part of God's camp. The point of this story is it is. God has written himself into the story of Jacob. He's shown up on the scene to prove and to convince him that, Jacob, I am in your corner. I am in your camp. And by this one miscalculation, the next several verses are going to go haywire, as it seems like he's off track already in his first step into the promised land. It's not a matter of two camps, it's one camp, and God is in the camp of Jacob. We come to verses 3 through 8. We see that this two camps isn't just the defining vision. It becomes a perceived necessity. It's interesting how this word two camps plays its way out through this passage. Verse 3, Jacob sends messengers before him to Esau, to his brother in the land of Seir. How many are up on their Holy Land geography? That's just one of those things that you study for fun. Me neither, okay? Land of Seir, okay? Think of Israel. Jacob's coming up in up here, Sea of Galilee, Jerusalem, Dead Sea. He comes kind of in the middle, okay? And the towns that are going to be named, Mahanaim at the end of this chapter, Peniel at the end of chapter 33, Succoth. They're all right in the middle here between Sea of Galilee and the Dead Sea. The land of Seir is down underneath the Dead Sea. It's about 70 miles away. I did a Google search yesterday to see how far it is to Cabela's from here. Cabela's is 60 miles away, okay? You don't go 60 miles out of the way unless it's for something very important, like Cabela's, okay? So as Jacob is coming back into the land, there's no reason for Jacob to have to go down to Seir. That's where Jacob is. If anything, he'd go right to the middle to Bethel, where God had met with him before. There's no purpose for him to go down to Seir geographically. The only necessity is relationally. The issue is reconciliation. Why did Jacob leave the land of promise? Because of Esau. As he comes back to the land of promise, there's one foreboding reality in his mind. Esau. So I know, God, thanks. You're with me. I'm obedient. This is where you've called me. But God, what about Esau? The issue is reconciliation. Verse 5, he says, you know what? I need to send to Esau in order that I may find favor in his sight. Maybe he'll give me grace. Maybe he just won't be mad. That's all I'm hoping for in touching base with my brother Esau. The circumstances are of his own doing. You know, he wouldn't be in a mess if he wasn't such a schnook. If he wasn't such a little brother, he wouldn't have this problem. Anybody have little brothers, younger brothers, or younger sisters? You know what I'm talking about, okay? If he hadn't been such a younger brother, okay, yeah, you are the younger one, I'm sorry. He wouldn't be in this problem. A lot of times our problems are our own doing, aren't they? In fact, the problems that are the scariest are the problems that are our own doing. Because when I come to a problem that's not my own doing, I bank on the God of justice to give justice and do what's right. But when a problem is of my own making, the last thing I want is justice. Because I know what I deserve. I'm asking for mercy at that point. And Jacob comes into the land, he's needing mercy because it was he who stole the birthright. It was he who stole the blessing. And as the realization falls, it cascades in torrent upon torrent on Esau, as he's putting two together, he says, is he not rightly called the heel grabber? These two times he's stolen what belongs to me. And as that chapter ends up, chapter 26, chapter 27, it closes with the ominous music of Esau giving the lullaby to himself as he goes to sleep. I'm going to kill my brother. I'm going to kill my brother. I'm going to kill my brother. That's his solace back in chapter 27. It says that Esau hated Jacob. So Jacob sends these messengers down with the message, Esau, I'm in the land. I'm coming to see you. Maybe we could get together. I'd love to see you, kind of. Verse 6, the messengers come back. There's no verbal message that accompanies their coming back. We came to your brother Esau. He's coming to meet you. Oh, and there's 400 guys with him. What? Remember how many men Abraham brought to fight the kings of Mesopotamia? 318, 360, something like that. It was in the 300s. Okay. This is 400 men, and they're coming out for what purpose? What do you think is the first question that Jacob asks? Why? That's some welcoming committee. I don't think it's a good welcoming committee. What do you think? And as he starts putting two and two together, his fear, his guilt starts to act up. And he says, you know what? Here's what I need to do. The end of verse 7. Jacob was greatly afraid. He was greatly distressed. So he divided the people who were with him and the flocks, the herds, the camels into two camps. Okay. There's two camps at the beginning of this story. God's camp and... Okay. Not God's camp? No. Okay. Now the story moves forward. So if I'm going to survive in this land of promise and blessing with God's presence, the only way I can see my way through this is if I take my one camp and I divide it into two camps. Because for sure, one of these is a goner. If it's this one will live. If this one dies, then this one will. The only way I can see my way through this is to have two camps. And so he sets that up. Verse 8, he says, if Esau comes to one camp and attacks it, then the one that's left can escape. Why is he thinking this way? Because of the guilt in his own heart. This mess is of his own making. The one thing that he needs to be freed from his past is reconciliation. It's forgiveness. It's mercy. And it doesn't look like he's about to get it. We move forward, verses 9 through 12, and we come to probably the best part of this whole story. It's at the very center of it. It's a prayer. And if you study prayers in the Bible, this is one of the prayers you ought to study because it's so humble. It's so real. It's so transparent. It's really a beautiful thing. Not perfect, but it's a beautiful prayer. Verse 9, Jacob said, O God of my father Abraham, God of my father Isaac, Lord, Yahweh, who said to me, return to your country and to your kindred so I can do you good. I'm not worthy of the least of all the deeds of steadfast love and all the faithfulness that you've already shown to your servant. With my staff I crossed this Jordan. Now, I've become two camps. Please deliver me from the hand of my brother, from the hand of Esau, for I fear him. He may come and attack me, the mothers with the children. But you said, you will surely do me good. You'll make my offspring as the sand of the sea, which cannot even be numbered for multitude. You look at this prayer. Again, in the center of this prayer is the idea of two camps. God, there's two camps, yours and mine. Okay. Now, the only way I can live is to have two camps. I'll take my one camp and I'll divide it in half, and at best, maybe part of my camp will exist. Now he turns around in prayer, and his prayer acknowledges the reality of God. He says, God, I know you're real because you are the God who is at work in the life of my grandfather Abraham. I know those stories. I know how that you brought him out of that land that I've just left. I know how that you walked with him. I know that some of the kings of the age, they stole my grandmother, and you put your hand of protection on both my grandfather and my grandmother. You didn't let them touch the Lord's anointed. You provided for them. You came down and you talked with them. You called out Uncle Lot out of Sodom and Gomorrah. There were angels that were involved. God, you were real in the life of Abraham. I know that. God, you're the God of Isaac. You're the God who, when Isaac was wandering around in the wilderness trying to feed and to water all of the blessings of the flocks and the children that you'd given him, that you gave him well after well after well after well. And finally, you made room for him in a place that looked like it was working against him. God, I know you're real because you've worked for Abraham in the past. You've worked for Isaac in the past. And you would think the next thing he would say, you're the God of Abraham, you're the God of Isaac, and you're the God of... You would like him to say that, wouldn't you? He doesn't. He says, now God, you told me this is what I'm supposed to do, and I'm doing it, and I'm stuck, okay? This is where I'm at, but I'm here of my own doing, but partly of your doing. And he reminds him that this is where he's at. His prayer acknowledges God's direction. God, This is where you told me to go. I know this is what you told me to do. You ever get to that place of obedience where it's starting to look like it's not going to work? But God told me to do this. I thought this was what I was, and now this isn't quite making sense. His prayer acknowledges his own unworthiness, and this is what makes the prayer so beautiful. Finally, for the first time in his life, Jacob sees himself for the skunk that he is. He says, God, you know what? I really stink. Everybody's known it but me up to this point in my life. And God, I'm finally convinced. I'm the skunk. And wherever I go, I can't get away from my own stench. I take it with me. God, I'm not worthy of all the blessings. And as he prays, his prayer acknowledges God's hand of blessing with him. But not just the blessings. He says, you've given me children, you've given me flocks, and the fact that you've given me children and you've given me flocks in my stinkiness means you must be a God that loves me. Why do you do that? You're a God who's faithful. You're a God who has set his love on me and has kept your love for me. Do you ever wonder at God's love for you? You would. If you saw yourself for the skunk that Jacob saw him, he says, you know what? God, I don't deserve this. But because you are the kind of God that you are, I'm going to ask a crazy request. Would you do something more for me? And in this very transparent moment, he says, God, I need you to deliver me from the hand of my brother. Jacob, why are you in trouble? Yeah, it's my own fault, God, I know. I am where I am because of myself. Okay? That's what makes me stink. And God, I don't deserve what you've already given me, but I need you to give me more. It's not enough because you've called me to more obedience, and the only way I can do that is if you give me more blessing, more grace. And then finally, he wraps things up by saying, God, in fact, I love how verse 12 starts. But you said, whenever you get to that point in your prayer, when you can say, God, I stink, but you finally turned the corner and you've arrived at that place where God can begin to work in your life. God, here's where I'm stuck, but you. And that opens up a bright tomorrow. This is what you've said. You've said for me to come, not just to the land of my fathers, but to my kindred. Part of my kindred is my brother, the brother that I have wronged, the brother who wants to kill me. But you've told me to go here. You said to go back so that you will surely do me good. The idea there of Tov kind of ties in with Shalom. You will give me peace. You will give me prosperity. You will give me a good welfare. You will see to my wholeness of body, soul, of spirit. God, that's what you said you want to do for me. You've said that you're going to give me offspring. So God, if they're going to be like the sands of the sea, numberless, that's got to mean that he can't wipe them all out. God, this is, I'm not able to put this all together, but I thank you that you can. We come down to the last part of this chapter, verse 13 through 21. He comes up with this plan. He just prays this awesome prayer. He's like, yes, Jacob, you get it. And now, verse 13. So he stays there that night. And he comes up with a plan. And this plan is going to be a huge plan. He's going to take an expensive gift. As you count up all the animals that he has there, the ones that are given a number, and then there's some that aren't. The milk camels, it says it also sent their calves with them. So if all 30 camels had calves, the total number of animals that he sends is 580 animals. This is bigger in historical records than some towns gave for tribute to foreign kings. This isn't a little gift. Okay, this isn't a housewarming package for Esau. This is an expensive, large, grand gift that is meant on purpose to impress Esau. Impress Esau enough to wipe away the anger, the malice, the hatred. Have you ever tried to change somebody's attitude? How does that work? I like what the kids just went down to the harvest rally. A guy comes through the tent during one of the times for no reason, and it had no connection with anything. It was just for fun. He's dragging this large chain. And the guy up on the platform says, "Hey, why are you dragging that chain?" Turns around and says, "Well, you ever tried pushing one?" "Well, that's a good point. Carry on. See you later." You ever tried to change somebody's attitude? Trying to change somebody's attitude is like trying to push a chain, isn't it? It just doesn't happen. It doesn't go where you want it to go. And the harder you try, the more it backfires on you. He's trying to change Esau's attitude toward, but he's trying to do it in his own strength. "Jacob, what's wrong with you? You just got the picture. It's all about God, all about God's presence. And here you think it's all about you." And he separates them, and he gives them these messages that they're supposed to give. He says, "I want you to say this, 'Esau, my Lord Esau, your humble servant Jacob has all of these to offer you. My Lord Esau.'" And he says, "Be sure you include those titles. Those are really important titles because I want him to feel like he is something. And I want him to know that I know that I'm not what I'm supposed to be." He's turning around the titles, though, that God had put in place. That "I will cause everyone else to be your servant and you will be their master." And it's almost as if he's ready to give up the blessing. And so there's some discussion between commentators. Yes, he's giving up the blessing. No, he's not giving up the blessing. Here's the important thing. Jacob is willing to give up the blessing. The blessing that he took in his own strength. And that's an important thing, folks. I don't know if you've ever been at that place where you've been wrestling with God and you've been trying to hold back or you've been trying to grab onto. And it seems like you're getting what you want, but it's not working. And finally, God brings you to the place where you have to let it go. I remember wrestling with colleges. I had to make a choice one time, and I didn't want to go to one college. I just really didn't want to go there. I'd been there already. I got a taste for it. I didn't want to go back. But God said, I knew God was saying, "You've got to go back to this college." "No, I'll go to any college but that one." In fact, and I start making bargains with God. How I can serve him better if I do this and making promises. No. Okay, well, finally I came to the place. Okay, God, you're God. I'm not God. I'll submit. I'll go to that college. And as soon as I got to that place, God said, "Okay, that's what I was waiting for. I want you to go to the other one." I said, "Really?" Man. The important thing isn't whether or not he gave up the blessing. He can't give up the blessing. It was God's blessing to give. It's already his. But he was willing to give up what he'd gotten by his own means. That's what's important. We see all of a sudden a new Jacob. When he comes back into the promised land, he's a different man. He's a different man because of God's doing. He's a humbled person. He promises that he'll be there. He says, "Tell him I'm going to show up. Tell him I'm going to be there. Tell him I'll be there." The result there in verse 20, maybe. Just maybe I can appease him. And he uses the word there, kafir. It's the idea of maybe I can atone for all the wrong I've done. Can you atone for all the wrong you've done? You can't. When you finally get yourself square in the mirror and you see the skunk that you really are, you start to smell the bad breath that's from your own throat. You start to realize, you know what, there's not a blessed thing that I can do. But we try, don't we? We try to dig ourselves out of our hole. We try to impress people. There's just no way. I love how this story ends. He sends all of these things hoping that maybe he can't. He can't. He can't. Look at verse 21. The present goes on in front of him. But that night, he himself stayed in what? What's it say? The camp. Which camp? He stayed in the only camp that there ever was. It wasn't two camps. It was one camp. And God was going to begin a work in his life that night. God is going to come and touch him and bless him and change him forever. Here's the point of this story, folks. Don't number God out when he enters your camp. Okay? It's not God's camp and the camp that's not God's. You're either a part of God's camp or you're not a part of God's camp. Now, you might be here this morning and you've made some mistakes. You got yourself into some circumstances that you're your own doing. And they're shiners. You can't get away from them. Well, welcome to the club. Okay? The only way that any one of us finds God to be the God that he is when we find out the wretch that we ourselves are. And the beautiful thing about the gospel is God comes alongside and says, listen, okay, there's my camp, and you can be a part of it. Now, are you with me or are you against me? But the only way that you can come into my camp is when you see yourself for who you are. And you stop trying to impress other people with your works of righteousness. They're like filthy rags. When you stop trying to push the chain and change people's attitudes, you can't do that. When you try to compensate for your past, you can't make up for the wrongs that you've done. All you have to do is you have to stop and you have to look and say, God, in your grace, you've given me so much. And you look back at that cross and you see Jesus Christ who bore the wrath of God in your place. And you say, God, you've done so much for me in the past that I want to audaciously ask you to do more for me in the future. Would you make me your child? Would you bring me safely home by grace? You might be here and say, you know what? I don't deserve anything more. Good. You finally got the right idea. Now ask for God to give you more. Because that's the kind of God he is. It's not dependent on you. But so often we break down, it's God's camp and it's not God's camp. No. God has entered into your corner. And don't you miscalculate. He says, folks, you're in my camp.